Hello and welcome to The Week at Work. My name is David Gibney and I'm going to host this week. I'm joined by my co-host Michelle Bourne, but we've got a very special guest on this week. We haven't had a guest on in a few weeks, so this is great. We have Emily Duffy, who is the founder of Parable Communications. Emily's been doing some work on Oscar Traynor and the campaign that's been going on there for the last, it must be a year at least. More than a year, is it? But first, before we get into the Oscar Traynor stuff, because we will start off with this, can you tell us just a little bit about Parable Communications?
Yeah, so we're basically getting it up off the ground at the moment. The goal of the work of Parable Communications is to try and get the left more broadly to start saying what we are for rather than what we're against. I think, like, on the left, we love to describe what we don't want, but we actually are very, like, we can't actually manage to describe the beautiful future, the thing that we're actually all fighting for. And a lot of the times when right-wing communicators, they've got all of the money, like Leo Varadkar's gone and done this training in the US. They know exactly how to frame an issue. We saw how Trump reframed the issue of Kyle Rittenhouse from not guilty to innocent. They spend so much money and they have so much power. And what we end up doing is showing up and repeating their frames all the time, repeating their arguments and actually strengthening their positions. So my hope is to try and develop some sort of both training and research kind of communications group under Parable, where we the left gets a lot better at saying what we want, because I think it's probably our best chance of winning. Like, we can control what we say. We don't have control of how much money we have. We don't control about how much power we have, but we can at least control what we say. So that's kind of the principle of it. So I'm only getting started, though.
Great. Oh, it sounds brilliant. I mean, it's one of the things that I've been passionate about for quite some time, actually, because when on the 2nd of June in 2014, I think it was, I met with all of the different political parties about the establishment of an anti-water charges campaign. Mm. And the argument I made was that Mandate Trade Union, who I was representing at the meeting, would not engage in anti-water charges campaign, but would only engage in a campaign if it was for something such as right to water and water as a human-based. Yeah. So, It really bugs me when I see all of this negative. It's do you know what? It's the lazy option to go after the negative, to be anti something. It's harder work to be for something, but the results are always better.
Big time. And like, there's so much evidence of this. Like there's one example in Australia where one of their things was saying seeking asylum is not a crime. And like they would really pull on legalese stuff around people seeking asylum and refugee issues and things like that. And they actually managed to create the biggest opposition ever. It went from 10 to 20% through their own messaging of like conflating seeking asylum with criminality and all of that sort of stuff. So it's like, it actually, I think, is our best way to win. Like when we actually are brave enough to say what we want, we can get it. Like we're much more likely to get it. So yeah, I'm pretty passionate about it as well, but it's a hard task because we're so good. Like, I can find myself saying, Michelle, and tell you, like, at Uplift, we'd be like, not this. Like, oh, what's the opposite? What's the thing we want? What is it?
Go on, Michelle.
You have a lot of it on Twitter as well, where like people keep repeating what the opposition is saying or tweeting it or, you know, screenshotting it and making them into memes. I'm guilty of it as well.
It's so
easy to get sucked into. But actually what we're doing is repeating the messaging that they have gone and got training to get and use it for that kind of clickbait style of like, how shocking can we go for them to repeat our message over and over and over again? Like it works, but like we need to unlearn it.
Because I've got to qualify my earlier statement about it, because I am same as the two is, but sometimes you have to be against something too. So, you know, the tax cuts that went to high earners, you can't be, you know, I suppose you can be for the tax remaining as it is, but it's, you know, that the government are the people with power, they're about to change it. So you have to be negative on certain things. That's not the framing, that's the opposition to the policy change.
The person that I did my training with at Shek Rosor says, don't take your policy out in public, it's unseemly. Like, so there's actually a really great example of that around a campaign in the US where they wanted to save a library and they had to have a 0.2% tax increase in the local area to save the library. And they ran this whole campaign saying that, you know, we're going to, the vote is August 2nd, we're going to burn the books on August 3rd. And so everybody was like, burning books? That's horrendous. Why would you burn books? What's wrong with you? And then like a few days before the vote, they were like, well, actually a vote to close the library is like a vote to burn books. And so they changed the conversation from tax to library. And so that's one of the things I always say as well. Like, don't talk to me about tax. Don't talk to me about the economy. What does that actually mean? It means schools. It means roads. It means mental health services. Like if you want to talk about tax, talk about what tax actually does and actually is. So yeah, that's I brought up tax.
Well, it's useful conversation to get into because we're about to discuss Oscar Traynor Road. So you can tell us what we're for on Oscar Traynor Road as opposed
what
to
are we for on Oscar Traynor Road. Do you know that Oscar Traynor Road has the capacity to develop 2,600 beautifully built, secure public homes that would give everybody in the housing list in the area could potentially clear the housing list in the area? And it could basically mean, I interviewed a lovely 45-year-old man during the week who said he's still at home living with his father. And he said that what would it give him? It would give him freedom. It would give him the chance to move forward with his life. He could maybe start a relationship. He could put down roots. Said that everything would change for him. And that's what I found from speaking to everyone. It was a 23-year-old woman who said that she, in Coolock, who said that she had, her and her mates had basically given up and thought that, you know, we won't have a home. That this isn't something that's on the cards. And what we could do if we were to provide 2,600 well-built public houses on Oscar Traynor Road is provide those 23-year-olds, those 45-year-olds, those people who are building their lives, who want their lives, a chance to have a secure roof over their head, and not just a secure roof over their head, but the chance to put down roots and the chance to build community that is sustainable and meaningful and not run by the vultures that have come into our country. So yeah, if any of the councillors are listening, that's what I would say, is you can be ambitious and you can actually push for more. Please do.
So just for the listeners to understand, what's the state of play in Oscar Traynor Road? Because we covered this over the last year and a bit. The plans were rejected. All of these podcasts just run into each other in my head. Yeah. So I don't know if it's a year ago, a year and a half ago, or even 6 weeks ago, but it was rejected by councillors and it was brought back, or we're developing another plan with Dublin City Council. So tell us what's happened since then.
Yeah, so these grey hairs here from Oscar Traynor Road, this campaign's been going on for about 3 years. We campaigned really hard in O'Devany Gardens, and we were told at the time that O'Devany Gardens deal was too far gone. And that Oscar Traynor was all to play for, an Oscar Traynor. So we dug in really hard. We started off about three years ago. So there's 43 acres of public land. The current state of play is that the council are now being asked to vote on what they say is a and a massive inverted commas here, a compromise deal, where they would give the land to Glenveagh, and Glenveagh would then build 843 homes of a particular tenure mix, where I think it was like 40% social, 40% cost rental, and then they would sell some of the rest of the private units back to the council, which is completely upside down land. Like if the state decided, if Dara O'Brien, the Minister for Housing, decided he was going to develop this land and borrowed at the money to do it at a really low interest rate, could build it. What was it, Michelle? It was like something like the how much cheaper it would be, 53 million euro or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, it was like it was working out like 60,000 cheaper per home. So yeah, it was big money. I think it was like 58 million of saving if the state was to build directly. But like I think one of the main things that has been quite shocking about all of this is like the fact that the original proposal that was rejected like flat out by the council that Glenveagh put forward was then after that then an alternative plan of like public development was put forward by the councils cross party. The councillors came together, put together a proposal that they led on leading and passed that. And that was the mandate that they gave council staff to be like, right, we as the councillors who are democratically elected have decided to reject the Glenveagh deal, and we've put together an alternative proposal for publicly led development. And the council staff rejected it. So they just flat out rejected that mandate and went behind the councillors' back and have spent 6 months working with Glenveagh to put forward another proposal with Glenveagh, completely ignoring the democratic mandate that they had already to build to start developing and working on the and then they're using this whole, oh yeah, well, one is going to take shorter time than the other and on all of this kind of narrative. But at the same time, they had obviously absolutely no intention in following the democratic mandate that was put out by the councillors for that alternative plan, publicly led plan in the first place, which is I don't know how the councillors are kind of standing up for it, like, because, you know, they've had so many powers withdrawn from the councillors already, particularly around the decisions around homes. Yeah. And this is just quite shocking that this is so blatant that they were like, right, well, we're just going to completely ignore you, turn around and go back to the private developer and work with them.
And I think, yeah, to speak directly on the Labour and Greens, I think in this situation, like, it feels as though they've thrown their hands up and said, look, this is a fait accompli. We've tried our hardest and this is what we're doing. And now we're going to accept this deal. And I mean, it shows a complete lack of ambition and a lack of a position, you know, that when you, and again, this goes back to the way that the right defined the frame of play, right? Is that they say it's going to take this long, so you have to accept this other deal, and kind of centre left parties or centrist right parties, left Labour and the Green Party, instead of saying, hold on, why is that the case? Why is it the case that the state is going to take this amount of time to develop that land? And actually, we should be taking this fight directly to the Minister for Housing. We should be taking it directly to the national government, instead of holding a position and taking that position and fighting for it. It would completely internalise and accept the idea that public housing takes longer, which just isn't true. Look at how Devonny Gardens is tied up in the High Court right now because Barter Capital are trying to get permission to sell the units to a vulture fund, you know. And so they keep on saying, oh, the Emmett Road, which is the St Michael's Estate public development, they keep being saying that that's going to take forever. But the truth is that this is all manufactured. But if the state really wanted to do it, they could go in there tomorrow. They could, as Rory Hearn has said, start a state construction industry, give people decent, permanent, well-paid jobs, get in there, build lovely eco-social houses, if they were all of the means possible to do it. But the councillors seem to have accepted their power has been stripped, and they seem to have accepted that they have no position to fight.
If only there was a historical record of this state intervention sort of working in the past. Do you know what I mean? Like, my family are from down the road there in Whitehall. My parents were both brought up in council housing there that was built for them. And when their families were moved out of the city centre back in the 50s, 40s and 50s and stuff like. So for these parties who are around and were the ones that implemented those policies back then, to be just ignoring that whole system. But it brings me to three articles that I read in the paper today, which are all interlinked, but that are, and you might have a comment on some of this, Emily, but on, I don't know what page it is, I think it's page 2 or 3 of the Sunday Business Post, Burke asked Department of Housing to find flaws in the ESRI report. And you might have heard about this last week, where the department, when they received the ESRI report saying you should borrow up 6-7 billion euros and start building public housing yourself and establish a state agency, all that argument that we'd make on the left, immediately it wasn't, like, within an hour, the department, rather than read the report and figure out what it says and take in its observations, was immediately looking to undermine that report and say this would never work. And from this, it's saying here that the minister and senior officials in the Department of Housing were pushing back against the ESRI plans and freedom of information requests from who's the freedom of information request from again? I think it's Thomas Gould.
Thomas Gould, I think.
Yeah, from Sinn Féin. Again, same guy who this came from in the first place. But anyway, it's showing that the minister, here's what the quote is from what was, the minister is going on drive time on Thursday evening, rehousing for all. He wanted me to try and get some stats for him to as rebuttals to the ESRI argument that more must be invested, borrowed to support increased levels of delivery. So here's the department actively engaging in undermining what they would call the ESRI, an independent report. The ESRI is not an independent body. It's funded by the state. It's funded by the same people who are trying to undermine the report. It's just farcical stuff. But that was the first one that I spotted in terms of, and it's specifically related to Oscar Traynor as well. Go ahead, Michelle.
I think on that is actually really interesting because I read the same article, and like the staff person who was rebutting back was like, wait, I'm misunderstanding what you're saying here. So you're saying we need to fight back against the fact that they've said we can borrow 4 billion in the budget. That is what the Housing for All plan actually says they're going to do. So he was actually going against their own plan. And we all know, we talked about it here already, how the Housing for All plan says absolutely nothing other than give money to investors and landlords. But he was actually rebutting his own plan by saying, yeah, no, I don't want to borrow 4 billion. Find a flaw in that, because it's actually in their own plan. So like,
Here's the quote from the bit that Michelle's talking about. So in response, a senior member of staff at the Department of Housing said, "I am slightly unclear as to what we are expected to rebut. Are we not doing what the ESRI has proposed?" So this is all about narratives, and going back to, you know, setting up parable communications. This is about narratives, right? And being able to say, this would never work, despite being in our plan. This type of investment, state intervention never works. What we need to do is X, Y, and Z, which is basically hand money over to private developers and allow them to do it. And sticking with the narrative element, because this is, I've been engaged in the media side of things for a long, long time, and observing how things are portrayed. So you have that at the start of the Business Post, and on page 18, you have a headline of demonized funds say that they are a part of the solution as rental crisis deepens. Now, this is vulture funds and cuckoo funds and all the rest of it, right? I don't like the headline. The article is by Killian Woods. I don't think we should be printing demonized funds say they are part of the solution as rental crisis deepens, because that's not what the story is. That's purely a press release coming from vulture funds, and we're regurgitating it as part of the story now, right? And now in people's heads, it's, oh, maybe they could be part of the solution. They're not part of the solution. They will never be part of the solution. Their only objective is to make profits. They don't give a shit about people being homeless, right? The more people that are homeless, the higher their profits are going to be, because there's more of a demand for the rent, right? Fast forward 2 pages, is it? Hold on. It's 10 pages. Page, I think it's 27. I don't know if you've got it in front of you there as well, Michelle.
Yeah.
Dan O'Brien, the man who they hired, who has almost convinced me to end my subscription with the Sunday Business Post, he says, foreign investors are neither vultures nor cuckoos and should be welcomed. And when you read into the article, which is just, it's infuriating, he starts off giving us a nature lesson about what vultures and cuckoos do and the services they provide to society. A bit of the Michael Noonan element to it there. And then he goes on and he makes comparisons, and he says, with other parts of Europe. And sorry for ranting on, because I'm going to end at this and I'm going to let you two back in, right? But he goes on and compares Irish house prices Dublin house prices were 4 times the average income in 2019, is what he says in the middle of the article. Lower than London, Birmingham, New York, Toronto, Sydney, and Auckland, but higher than Belfast, Cardiff, Liverpool, and Chicago, right? So he's given these comparisons on figures that are completely irrelevant, because he uses average wages is what he says. Now, just for the listeners, the reason I say this is he should be using median instead of average, right? It's because median would give you the point at which 50% earn more, 50% earn less, whereas average is skewed by the high earners over there in the IFSC and everyone else. The fact of the matter is Irish society, we have more higher proportion of low paid jobs than anywhere else in Europe, bar UK. And that's, you know, I use that figure. The UK are no longer in the EU. So I'm saying in Europe, all of Europe, we have higher amount of low paid jobs. It doesn't show up on the average figures. Our average incomes are almost €40,000 a year. Our median is €30,000. So when it comes to comparing incomes and your rental, it's more important to look at what people are actually earning, as opposed to data that's skewed by some fucker earning €4 million in a multinational firm. So anyway, This is, again, go back to parable. I'm going to invite Emily to come in around this stuff, but the narrative in that you've got on page 2, you know, the department trying to rebut their own independent organization's plans around housing. You've got a headline from the media, that's from the mainstream media, on an article. The headline is saying that vulture funds and cuckoo funds, these are part of the solution, not the problem. And then you have Dan O'Brien, a columnist, saying cuckoos and vulture funds should be welcomed.
Yeah.
And that all sits in people's head. Now, it's the Business Post, so it's for a certain cohort of of readership. But anyway, Emily, I don't know whether you have any observations.
Like, believe it or not, like, I'm actually delighted with that, because that's the exact conversation that we want them to be having. In fact, we want them to be continuing to use the term vulture and cuckoo, because we know that it's effective. And so now that they're showing up and defending vultures and cuckoo funds, it doesn't matter. I don't care what anyone says. Like, the average person in the street, you talk to them about a vulture fund or a cuckoo fund, no matter how many times you try to reframe it as vultures having a place in the ecosystem, it's just not going to happen. Like, it's not going to happen. I think it's a little bit like what happened in the UK or in the NHS, in that communicators and campaigners won the argument around the NHS. That has been won now, that people are for the NHS and people believe in a public health system. I think that the argument around public housing has been won in Ireland. However, the actual nuts and bolts of it are very different. And so what we see is the likes of Dara O'Brien, and like, this is why they're tying themselves in knots, right? Because they don't know what cost rental means. Like, so like, I mean, I remember reading recently Fianna Fáil trying to find a way for developers to make profit out of cost rental and still call it cost rental. So, like we've basically won the argument. We've won the narrative and framing, but we actually haven't won the policy changes, which is why actually, even though you don't take your policy out in public, we need to really drill in about that. And I would actually really argue that we need to go back to talk about social housing, and maybe step away from affordable housing and cost rental and things like that, because the more that we give them our language to use, the more that they use it and twist it, and actually it becomes something else. And so that's a big question that I haven't answered, is what actually happens when you win the argument, but the actual things that are happening on the ground, it isn't happening. But like, we now, I remember actually in Uplift, we sat down about 4 or 5 years ago, and we're like, what's going to get us there? We're like, we want the parties to be competing to be talking about how they're going to build the most social housing. And that kind of happened in the last election. But then we're like, well, actually, that's not worth the paper it's written on, even in Housing for All. What they're saying and what they're doing are two very different things. So I think that is our challenge now on the left, is to how do we talk about it in terms that is about public housing on public land, publicly built, with vultures and developers and all those people out of it. I don't think I've quite figured it out yet. I'm not sure which way this vote on Oscar Traynor is going to go on Monday. And it's interesting. I don't know what you feel about it, Michelle, but like, you win and you win and you win and you win. And however, the profiteers still hold the cards. The deck is still stacked.
Yeah, that's it. And they're using the language against you as well. Like, as you say, like, the Housing for All, and I said it here before, like, the Housing for All plan, like, that name is literally ripped from the Homes for All campaign that was against the government a couple of years ago. And that term affordable housing doesn't actually mean affordable housing anymore. What does affordable even mean? There is no definition really that's been out there. So like, yes, they're using our language and using our terms, but actually they're using it to whitewash what's actually happening, you know, like, what does that actually mean anymore? It's hard to kind of play on it. Like, you're saying, yes, there's wins there in like, we're talking about it, but now we have this battle of trying to actually, what does that actually mean when you say it, as opposed to when we say it? Because they mean very different things.
Very different things. And I think trying to make sure that the public interest stays. And actually on that point, trying to get our narratives into the media, which is something we were talking about earlier, is extremely difficult, particularly around Oscar Traynor. I think maybe I'll let you talk on this, Michelle, but like, we're pretty decent campaigners. Like, we can get stuff into the media usually. We know how to deal with the media and get things into the media. O'Devney Gardens and Oscar Traynor was impossible to get any coverage on. Any coverage. Poll after poll after poll. We ran 3 opinion polls, big opinion polls, one at Red Sea, one at Behaviour and Attitudes, another one at Red Sea, that showed that people wanted public homes in that land. They wanted, 94% of people said they wanted public homes over private homes built in the country. And we didn't get, it was virtually impossible to get any of those opinion polls into papers. And Michelle, I think you had a bit of an experience with that.
Yeah, they wouldn't touch it. And like, even around the vote, upcoming vote on Monday around Oscar Traynor Road, there was like a number of different pieces of kind of like bits of the story that needed to be told around, like, you know, how, for example, the council are only allowed councillors to go in and view the proposal. And the proposal, so that means you can't bring any experts in. You can't bring anyone who might be able to help you read that proposal if you're not an expert, you know, in like reading like big contracts or whatever. You're also not allowed to take a pen or paper or take any photos of the proposal at all. So you're expected to make a decision by being in this room uninformed, but no one there to help you read the document in a way that's digestible to you as a counsellor before you make that vote. But you're also not allowed to take any notes in order to get those fact checks or take those numbers down to be like, oh yeah, I just need to work this out. No. And more importantly, the last section, the most important section, the financial section, had just a load of subheadings with 000 or no written numbers written beside it at all. There is no financial section in the proposal that has been showed to councillors. And yet we can't get this covered in the paper. We can't get anyone to cover the story of Oxford Trainer Road because the journalists who are interested in it are writing about it and telling us that they've written an article about it. And their editors are saying, no, we're not publishing. They go to comment to Glenveagh Capital and whatever Glenveagh says to them scares them so much that they will not publish what is happening on Oscar Trainer Road. So like right now, we're coming ahead of a big vote tomorrow. And there's not one story in the paper this weekend about Oscar Trainer Road. And that is by design. Not because we haven't been ringing every journalist we can try to get this story. It is by design. And it's absolutely shocking.
Wow. I hadn't heard any of that before. Censorship. It reminds me of the time they were negotiating TTIP. And all of the members of the European Parliament were allowed in. They weren't allowed to take their phones with them, their pens with them, their paper with them. So they weren't allowed to, they had to try and memorize everything. This seems to be a tactic that the Dublin City Council are starting to employ.
And I mean, and the line on it is that it's commercially sensitive information. And can again, I haven't seen any of the major parties question why the commercial sensitivity of a private developer, it takes precedence over our value for money on our public land and our public homes. I haven't seen that argument. I haven't seen it happen.
But also, how could it be commercially sensitive? It has absolutely no financial breakdown in the proposal. That
exactly.
What exactly is the commercial sensitivity there? When councillors went to ask for, sorry, is the financial bit missing? Like, where is it? And they're like, oh no, we don't have access to that. Like, literally, it can't. How are councillors supposed to make a decision where they were given just over a week to view this proposal, in the midst of they had been all dragged in to stay in past midnight because the council did that whole where they tried to sneak in 220 rezoning applications into the development plan of Dublin City Council. So they had councillors in every night trying to firefight the fact that the council staff had snuck in a load of rezoning applications into the development plan. One of the councillors copped it. So then they were all dragged in to talk about every single individual one of those rezoning applications, rather than saying, absolutely not. That was put in there illegally. They were all supposed to be mandated and voted on before they could be even put into a development plan. Instead, again, the councillors have played the council staff's game again and just said, okay, well, we'll just stay in all week and we'll stay in all night and we'll look at all of those rezoning applications. At the same time, they were supposed to be looking at the actual proposal that was being put forward to them on vote. How are they supposed to be playing any proper detail to what was in that proposal when they've been kept in all night playing the council staff's game by trying to debate all those rezoning applications? Like, they're been set up to fail.
Yeah.
Like, they're literally been set up to fail.
But the total undermining of democracy here. Like, the fact that what strikes me immediately is that it's, I mean, this is Dublin City Council and Glenveagh Properties, right? For value for money, as you mentioned, Emily, there for the public, everything should be out to tender.
Yeah.
This isn't out to tender anymore. I know they won a tender in the past, but that was rejected,
that's
right?
That's where the really dodgy stuff comes in. I mean, there may be serious actual legal issues here around what Dublin City Council have just tried to pull with this deal, because basically the Labour and the Dublin Agreement parties went back and said, okay, we've put this alternative proposal together. And instead of re-tendering for that, instead of trying to make that an actual viable possibility, Dublin City Council Owen Keegan said, do you know what? It's great. Glenveagh still wants to stay involved, isn't it? So magnanimous of them. They're about to get 43 acres of prime public land at a €53 million discount, by the way. And we've actually managed to do it so that we don't have to re-tender and we can actually get these homes built and it won't take, you know, 50 years like every public planning thing takes. And I'm pretty sure there are grounds to challenge that legally.
Yeah.
Like, I think it's like in terms of tendering, it's ridiculous.
But this is the other element of it. I think Connor McCabe might have, or maybe it was you, Michelle, on the previous podcast was talking about was, any other company that hasn't had the opportunity to go for this now will be able to sue the state. because they tendered for the previous one, and now all the guidelines and all the parameters are scrapped, and they're going with an individual company and allowing them to make the profits off this without giving access to anybody else. It's a minefield, you know, and it might not even be to the Irish courts. It might be to the European courts for loss of profits or loss of opportunities or whatever you want to call it. Whereas just engage a state agency and build the fucking things yourselves, lads. It's cheaper. It's faster. Look, I'm going to go and move on to other stories, but I'm going to actually stick to the housing theme because there's an article here by Michael Brennan, again in the Business Post. Banks criticised for refusing to finance cargo container homes. And this is, there's a big picture there of Ivana Bakic saying, and a quote from her under the picture, saying banks should be glad to finance them. But it's an interesting one that... first of all, that this is the major issue that the Labour Party are campaigning on in relation to housing is about turning cargo containers into homes because they can be done cheaper rather than actually just doing what you guys are doing, actually campaigning on and not giving up, not throwing your hands up into the air about Oscar Traynor Road. But just looking at the costings of these things, like it costs 59,000, 60 grand for a 3-bed container home. If you wanted to convert them, there's GLT Homes, a Loud County Loud company that's building these things. I don't know if you guys have any observations on this stuff, but I personally wouldn't fancy living in a container. Now I know some of them, they look nice and all the rest of it, but I mean, we can do better than fucking container, cargo container homes, if you ask me. And the fact that this is the big issue, and maybe it's not, we said this last week, I think myself and Conor were on last week saying the big ticket items that the Labour Party appear to be campaigning on are just, I just don't get it. These are not appealing to the general population. So why are they going after them? Are they trying to make themselves irrelevant? Or is this really an issue that people, so many thousands of people are really upset because they can't take a cargo container off a ship and build a house around it? Like it's mad. I don't know.
Yeah, it's like they're trying to create a new market for things that nobody actually wants. And I don't feel like the Labour Party should actually be in that space. And like then there's the other bill that they're bringing forward around being able to rent unfurnished homes. And I'm like, OK, so we're going to pay like $2,000 for rent a month that I'm not going to have any furniture for, right? But then if I decide to invest in my own furniture and like bring that from like rental to rental, bearing in mind, we have very little security of tenure. So I could be moving that furniture like every year, for example. Some of the apartments that I might be looking at will have furniture. So and then where do I put my furniture? I pay for it to put it in storage. Like, I don't know what is going on. But like my experience of renting is if there was a piece of furniture that I had or some of my friends had, they just ask the landlord to like, oh, will you move that couch out? Or I have my own bed, like I'm bringing, you know, and it would just not be a problem. Like that's the landlord's part, like, you know, sort it out, you know what I mean? Nice. Like I don't know where these bizarre proposals are coming from.
It's like people in the Labour Party have never met or spoke to or listened to a working class person before, like, which is highly ironic. But like this is what happens when there's parties with like who have this shift to middle class voter bases who think that they can, but have absolutely, like, it just is to me, their policies at the moment are so emblematic of the fact that they have no connection to the working class, that they're not members of the party, they're not canvassing the party, they're not voting for the party, and it's very, very clear in what is coming out, in that it's kind of like a liberal politics around this stuff that is based in no ways in reality whatsoever. But it's bizarre. It doesn't take much to even read about what we're asking for, you know, as a working class. But like,
I'll move off housing now. and I'm going to go to one that I wanted to talk about anyway. So the front page of the Business Post today is government seeking to avoid circuit breaker lockdown as ICU crisis looms. So this is obviously the big increase we've seen. There was over 5,000 again cases confirmed yesterday. It says 5,959 cases, so almost 6,000 cases yesterday. And the fears and the worries of the government because of the ICU crisis that's looming. I think last week or the week before we reported that there was an American body organization who runs with these statistics, who's been right in the past, who's been claiming that Ireland's about to see 12,000 per day And if we do see 12,000 per day, we're in very serious shit in terms of the hospital capacity and the ICU. And this article here is telling us about, you know, the capacity to take over private parts. 15% of private hospitals should COVID-19 cases surge, right? And we can get into that now in a second. But what I wanted to talk about was the fact that I've been on to retail workers this week in multiple outlets, by the way, not just one multinational, but two multinationals, where I've had very close conversations with retail workers who've been talking about this. And the policies, I'm not going to name them because I could get in trouble, but the policies that the government are implementing on the back of Neffet's advice, and you mentioned it there, Emily, about the disconnect from the working class people, completely ignores the reality for retail workers on the ground who can't afford to self-isolate for 5 days. So what the government's restrictions now are is if someone in your household or some close contact comes across you and you've been identified as a close contact, you have to self-isolate for 5 days and take 3 antigen tests, right? Now, that's all well and good if somebody can afford to take the days off, particularly in the run-up to Christmas, where retail workers get overtime, they get premium hours on certain days and above beyond certain hours, early mornings, late nights, all that sort of stuff. So they're being asked now to self-isolate if something comes up. And I spoke to a couple of different people I know in retail to ask them what they were planning on doing. And they were way ahead of me. They said to me, we already had a meeting in our store in the break room, and everybody's saying that they're just going to come into work as normal if they're a close contact because they can't afford to take the time off. And I said, and what are you planning on doing, like, around the potential for having it? Well, they said, we're going to take the antigen tests ourselves. And I said, well, are you going to have to pay for them yourselves? Absolutely, because unless we identify ourselves as a close contact, we don't get the free antigen tests that the HSE will send out. So here we have tens of thousands of retail workers who deal with tens of thousands of people every day saying that they're going to ignore Neffet's advice because of financial insecurity. Now, there is the enhanced illness benefit, which they could avail of, which I think the maximum they can come out with is 350 quid a week. That's if they manage to get it and jump through all the hoops that they would have to. But PUP is being phased back, so they're in trouble around that stuff and all the rest of it. But it just, the thing that annoyed me about it when I was talking to, because RTE were on to me about this during the week, the thing that annoyed me was how disconnected everybody is. There's 300,000 people working in the retail industry in Ireland, right? They come across, every single person has to go to the shops. These can be major spreaders, super spreaders of the disease. If they have it, they don't know they have it, they haven't got the symptoms, they're stacking shelves. More consideration needs to be given to this, because it's such a danger to reducing ICU and the COVID figures, ICU capacity and the COVID figures. If we really want to tackle this, we need to be looking at the people who are in these positions. But instead, you know, we give them a round of applause and then we tell them self-isolate, lose out on all the money and all the rest of it. And by the way, if you get the social welfare, you know, if you go sick, you lose out in your first 3 days anyway. Sick pay, you know, you're talking about people on close enough to the minimum wage losing out on their first 3 days, you know, in the run-up to Christmas, during a housing crisis. Rents are going through the roof. I think rents are at inflation levels of 10%, while inflation itself is at 5.1%. They can't afford a fucking day off, never mind 5 days off. People are living hand to mouth at the moment. So I don't know if you guys had anything to say about the COVID figures or any of the stuff that I just mentioned there.
I just think it's interesting around, like, you know, that idea of the whole, you know, work from home where possible. Like, what about the people who can't work from home? Like, what protections are they getting? Like, we talk about workplace outbreaks, but like, what about if your workplace is like one of frontline workers, like in hospitality, like, you know, providing us with food throughout the pandemic? Like, there is no real protections there for them. And this work from home messaging is important, obviously, for anyone who can, but for a lot of people, that's not a possibility. Like, you know, I don't, like, it's hard. Like, I definitely don't blame the workers at all who say that like, we're talking about being able to afford to live here. So how do we balance that when the government haven't put in enough protections for us to be able to do that? It's terrible. And I saw there was an article actually in Sunday Business Post as well, where they are talking about renewed discussions for the hospitality sector and wage subsidy schemes and PUP this week. So it'll be interesting to see what comes out of that. But not even for hospitality, but also for the event sector, who they've just cut hours off their workday in a very precarious work sector anyway. A lot of those people are working for themselves, working on gigs, you know, and when those gigs are cancelled or cut 2 hours or 3 hours off them, that's you're talking about like a number of artists being cut there. Or if they can do it, we've seen some people moving the gigs earlier and stuff, but there's absolutely no wage support for them right now, because we've just cut the PUP back. We've cut a lot of the supports, and the people who signed off the PUP in order to start running gigs and start running events and all of this, because they were told the place is opening, now can't get back on the PUP.
Yeah.
Just by having no work.
Yeah. I think it's so clear that the people who are designing our laws, the people who are designing our public health advice, haven't worked a day in retail or haven't, you know, had to live in a gig economy possibly ever. They probably don't even know that many people who do either. And like, there's just, it's like, I feel like overall the message right now is like, handle it yourselves, like just figure it out. Yeah. And with no support. And like, even the stuff that's coming out about antigen testing at the moment, like they've closed. I remember a few times had symptoms during the summer, and there was a walk-in test center around the corner for me in the Liberties. And I could just walk around, get PCR test and get the results the next day. They've closed all of them down. So if you want to go and get a PCR test now, and if you don't drive, which I don't, you have to get a Lewis to City West, which as a symptomatic person, potentially not the best thing to do. Or unless if you can't afford a taxi, never mind, you're putting a worker at risk if you get into the taxi as well. So there's no access to rapid, decent PCR testing. Tony Holohan has now come out this morning and said, only use an antigen test if you're not symptomatic, which is really odd advice, because they're more accurate when you are symptomatic, for first of all. And so we only want to use antigen tests as an additional measure. But if there isn't PCR, if there isn't good public available free PCR testing actually available to people, then people can't, they can't go and get a test and have the results the next day. So they're going to go into work. What should be happening, I think, is that the retail people should be providing, or the government should be providing, an antigen test that people can test themselves 3 times a week. And proper sick pay. But it is very much like, just you've been left to handle it now.
It's about personal responsibility. Like, you know, well, I was listening on the radio yesterday, and they're talking about having Neffert, we're talking about having two close contacts that you can have in your bubble outside of, you know, your workplace and the people who are essential to meet, two individuals. And you're like nightclubs are still open, lads, pubs are still open, no restrictions around any of this stuff. You know, people are being cramped into full capacity public transport, and you're telling me I can only meet two of my family members. It's just nuts stuff. And then you talk about, again, narratives, which I think is important, and how the media in some instances is not anymore just, not that it was ever just about, you know, reporting the news, but like Jennifer O'Connell had a piece there Saturday, November 13th, which is only a week and a half ago or so, right? We've had enough of being micromanaged by Neffert. It's almost lobbying. Like, we've had enough of being micromanaged by Neffert. A week later, ICU doctors speak out. There's no opportunity. Optimistic scenario. There's only pessimism and carnage. That's our next article. Do you know what I mean? Like this, and then you have Mark Paul with his on the Friday, October 22nd, writing an article. Let's talk about acceptable COVID death rates before restrictions kick in. And then yesterday writes, when all is said and done, it is clear government didn't do enough to stop this surge. Like, I try to figure out in my head what goes through their heads when they're writing these pieces a couple of weeks ago, and then able to do a full reversal, turnaround, brass necks. Like, how can you write that stuff a couple of weeks ago and then complain about the government and say that it's all the government's fault? The government was lobbied, because the government read those newspapers. Ministers, the department officials, they all read those newspapers and they go, well, Mark Paul seems to be reflective of what the public opinion is about this stuff, so let's do what he says. Let's have acceptable deaths. You know, and then they do it, and then Mark Paul's going, oh shit, now we're going back into a lockdown. And he doesn't see himself as part of the problem, so... I don't know. Will we move on to another story there? I don't know, Michelle, have you got any stories you wanted to raise?
Yeah, just real interesting, right? There's this pullout in the Sunday Business Post this weekend called the Employment Investment Incentive Scheme Opportunities, which is just like and a few pages of like things that you can spend all your money in if you've loads of money. Like obviously it's for their audience, but I didn't read all of it, but I was just interested on page 3 where there was a couple of things around environmental investments that you can get involved in. This is a new space, obviously. So there's one here around the reverse vending machines offer a chance to back the future is the headline. So it's talking about like deposit and return schemes for like plastic bottles and all of that, which is a good thing, right? But yeah, basically they're kind of like pitching this now as a huge investment opportunity where there's a large market opportunity for people to make loads of money. And they have, it's just really interesting to see like how businesses are now engaging with this greening of, Ireland or whatever, and what that actually looks like. Well, first of all, we're focusing on these initiatives, which to be honest, are talking about individual responsibility and individual action. You know, if we're, encouraging deposit return bottle schemes, which is better than obviously where we're at, we're focusing on the consumer action of us recycling after we've bought the plastic bottles and all of that. We're actually not tackling the root of the problem at all, which is actually, why aren't we targeting the actual companies who are providing all of this plastic, like this once-off plastic that we'll use, and not actually, you know, legislating for them or to, and actually, I think if I'm right in saying, there was actually a really interesting piece, yeah, sorry, on the inside, Senator Lynn Ruan has actually brought a bill around the private members bill compelling businesses to report their annual greenhouse gas emissions. So we're starting to see finally people talking about moving away from like, oh, what's your individual carbon footprint, and actually talking about the company's footprint. I know, for example, Niall Sargent of the Journal, who does investigations for Noteworthy, was doing a piece on the cost of carbon, and he was trying to get the emissions data for even state companies and never mind like private businesses and all, and he couldn't get it. He said it was absolutely impossible, he was jumping through hoops, and they weren't legally obliged to even provide that information to the state. So when we're talking about, you know, the climate action bill and like the targets that we're meeting, we can't even get the data. How are we supposed to know who's meeting what? So this is really I think this is great to see Senator Lynn Ruan bring this bill, where it's going to talk about where it also has to include how the companies plan to reduce their emissions in line with national plans. So this is really helpful because it talks about, like, we'll be able to see now timelines that the companies have a responsibility. Now, obviously, if it passes, that's me suggesting that they're going to pass. But that's really interesting. Like, I thought on the other note, there was a really interesting, I think it was the Labour Party are bringing a bill on the individual carbon footprint of products. During the week, I saw something, I think it was the Labour Party, where they are proposing that each package, each product that you buy in a shop, like a banana or whatever, would have to have its individual carbon footprint on it, which is kind of the opposite problem again, where the customer again is being forced to make a decision and feel guilty about their purchase on the basis of what the carbon footprint is, rather than actually targeting the supermarkets and all of that, and that kind of conversation about what their responsibility is and the products that they source and they provide to customers, not the customers who decide to buy into that. Again, it's shifting that whole like narrative of like consumer guilt around climate and how we as individuals have to individually target climate change rather than the collective responsibility of supermarkets and companies who actually provide those decisions to consumers and the government policy that underpins that. Like it's just really interesting. It all seems to be happening at the one time. So you can kind of like compare and contrast the different approaches of, like, for example, Senator Lynn Ruan to the Labour Party, or, you know, vice versa. So it's just really interesting.
And it's so interesting as well, is that like they make money out of the, they made money out of the problem, and now they're going to monetize the solution as well. It's just like, does capitalism ever lose? But it's really funny though, because both carbon footprint and climate change are right wing talking points. Like they were constructed in those right wing think tanks.
BP oil yeah. Coined the term carbon footprint in order to deflect responsibility off themselves and onto the consumer. Like
recycle is another one as well. It's like, it's all, and also it's like we're drowning. Like we are actually literally drowning in plastic. No matter how, you know, amazing a consumer you are, when you're also, you know, trying to pay your rent, worry about COVID, figure out public transport, do all those kind of things. You're also all meant to now also be thinking about your reduced reuse, recycling, your carbon footprint, and your car, all that sort of stuff. And no, I think it's a, I think it's definitely a ploy, like a lot of these schemes. And we would have campaigned an uplift for the bottle deposit scheme because it is a sensible scheme. But at the end of the day, like, you have to go further up the river. Like, you have to go up to the source, as you say, Michelle, of where all of this plastic is coming from, where the carbon is coming from, and where are those solutions happening. But I think they know that it's quite easy to make tired people who are exhausted by capitalism already feel guilty. So they're like, grant, we'll just push it back on them again.
It's again the disconnect from the working class about what they, the options that they have in reducing their carbon footprint when they see one particular good, you know, carbon footprint is 100, whatever it is, right? And then they see a more expensive item for 50 with 50 on credits or something on it, and they just can't afford it, and it's pure guilt. But the reality is the supermarket could reduce that by not wrapping the bananas in fucking plastic. They have a wrapper on them already. It's called skin. Michelle?
Yeah, just on that whole kind of conversation around, you know, the environment and everything. I know I kind of briefly mentioned on this before that I was going to be heading off to a conference on data centres. And some people might have seen some of the narrative around this. So yeah, last week I attended, as part of my work at Uplift, I attended the conference. It was a free conference. It was open to everyone, anyone who could attend this data centre, National Data Centre Conference. So essentially what it was, when I walked in, first of all, I was basically the only woman there. There was all men in grey suits. And there was me trying to, like, you know, fit in with the crowd. I was never going to be fitting in. There's the crowd there. Trust me on that one. But yeah, essentially, this conference, which was sponsored by ESB, bearing in mind the link with data centres and the pressure on our grid and all of that, ESB are sponsoring this conference. So, like, just to set the tone about where we are in this discussion. The conference opened with, like, and I was looking, like, I had, like, the lineup of the events is all like decarbonize this, sustainability this and that. And like, you'd think with all the buzzwords they were using that it actually meant something, but I can tell you it did not. Like, they were talking about how, you know, gas as if it was the save all of everything and like so sustainable and all of this. Never once did I hear the word fossil fuel or like, you know, extractive, like distraction. Any of that, none of that. But it was really interesting because there was this MC guy who was like terrifying, kind of Joe Rogan, Jordan Peterson type kind of personality, who was like jumping in between panel discussions with this real like, you know, we can be sustainable, decarbonized. At one stage, tried to convince the audience that data centers could save the bees. So at some point, I actually was like, sorry, I'm actually doing loops on how you're trying to do this. Basically, he was saying like some of the investments that they were putting in was like towards saving the bees. So all of his interjections in between these panel discussions on like so-called decarbonization was about how he was going to save the bees. At one point, he actually said how he brought back the giant panda from extinction or from threatened extinction. Like pictures of bees and pictures of pandas and somehow linking this to data centers, sustainability and decarbonization. Now, the man with a piece of work, he actually challenged me at the end. I'd made a couple of interactions at the conference, interactions, like asking questions that I didn't want to answer. I once did, I had a panel laugh at me over like why they, was a panel on EU regulation. So I was asking questions like, do you think like the regulate our, you know, our climate action plan, you know, or our, you know, our tax haven bits are reasons why, you know, big data center companies are coming here because our like Ireland is really bad at acting on like GDPR and data protection issues. The panel laughed at me and were like, no, there's lots of other reasons why data centers, HQs and big companies would come to this country. And I was like, all right, lads, if you can't give an answer to the question properly without us all being in a fit of giggles. But anyway, your man approached me at the end and was all like, if you have a problem with it, you should have just discussed it with. He was really annoyed that I'd been tweeting out some of his slides with the Save the Bees and the panda thing. That I'd actually called him out on his greenwashing online and that I should have. So he cornered me, like probably one of the only women there who was definitely younger than everyone else there, and decided to like try his little bully boy tactics because I'd actually called him out on his greenwashing. Like the whole thing was mad. But there was really funnily, in the middle of the whole data center, there was a protest planned. I think it was the COP26 coalition, I think it's moving into more of a climate justice coalition. So it was kind of like XOR, PVP, people that I recognized that were at the protest. So I knew that was happening around 12. But at the same time, there was a talk on by the ex Labour Party Minister for Environment, I think what's his name, Michael McGrath or Martin? Is it McGrath?
McNamara.
So he was there. He now heads up the lobby group for all of the big data center groups. So Amazon, Google, for this, I think it's called cloud infrastructure. And he was using his exposition, being like, oh, I used to be the Minister of Climate Action who brought in this bill. I'm great. I'm so sustainable. La, 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 la. And then is now working for lobbying for these big companies who are having a detrimental effect on our environment here and across the world. Like, they're global, massive destruction companies. But anyway, I was like, oh God, like I'll hold off until I go out to that protest just so we can get a couple of awkward questions into this. Next minute, fire alarm goes off. And I was like, that's very suspicious that the fire alarm would go off just as there's a protest outside. So the whole conference was evacuated. So you could just see streams of men in suits coming out of the RDS onto this protest. So the protest is there, shouting away, megaphones out, signs up, like stop data centers, la, la, la. The contrast was uncanny to see all of these men in suits on one side of the gates of RDS and on the outside of the RDS, everyone shouting about how, you know, how terrible data centers are on our environment, on our, on the national grid, on all of this. And like RTE were there as well. It's really interesting. But yeah, it was an eventful event. I was glad I went to it. And I'll be writing up a more detailed blog of some of the absolutely ridiculous quotes that came from that event from some of the panelists up on Uplift in the next week or so. But yeah, very, very interesting event. There wasn't too many activists that engaged with the actual conference itself. There was one guy who came in the first talk and like literally grabbed the mic, called them out on their greenwashing and dropped the mic and ran out. But like other than that, it was fairly, there was no one else really questioning a lot of the statements that were being made on stage. In fact, it was actually a really hard place to even engage with. And I met another person there who said that they were terrified to even ask the question because the atmosphere in the whole place was so like toxic. That it was just not a place for proper debate or discussion at all around what decarbonisation and sustainability actually means from a bunch of tech bros.
I'm on the Twitter account now, as you mentioned it, with the picture of the panda, giant panda eating a bit of bamboo there in the back. These guys, like, what planet do they come from? They're going to save the bees just like data centre saved the pandas. As someone who's visited Chengdu and the Panda Rescue Centre in Chengdu, there was no data centre involved in the rescuing of pandas whatsoever. And pandas are under... Well, look, I won't get too much into the detail of pandas because it's something I'm quite interested in, actually. But the bees, like, how the fuck is a data centre going to save a bee? How the fuck is redirecting water from the Shannon to Dublin because there's a shortage of water for these data centers? And by the way, when you mentioned about, hold on, that bit about data centers are moving here for X, Y, and Z reasons, they get free water here. They don't get free water anywhere else in the world because every other country, every other developed country in the world has abstraction charges. Ireland refuses to implement that abstraction charges for water. So they can get up to, even when they do plan on bringing in the water abstraction bill, they're planning on setting the threshold at over 730 million litres of water per year, which no data centre currently uses per year. So they still don't have to pay anything. There's not a single one of the data centres that's in existence in Ireland right now that will pay a cent under the water abstraction bill because we set the threshold so high. And the only reason we're setting the thresholds is because the EU is forcing us to set thresholds. Otherwise, we'd be saying, have your free water, have your free electricity, have whatever the fuck you want. Kill the bees. We don't give a shit. Just do what you have to do here to make a few quid. So it's hilarious. I'm telling people now, get on to Uplift's Twitter account because I hadn't seen this this picture of the poor old panda not knowing that he was rescued by this bald lad who does data centers. Come on, Emily.
Oh no, I'm shaking my head as well. Since somehow data centers are going to save pandas. I think this is it. This is the big question we have again with the left. It's like they'll take our language. They've lovely marketing teams. They know, but yeah.
Poor LBs don't even know that the data centers are helping them. I don't know. Emily, you wanted to talk about the mother and baby home redress scheme, did you?
I think it's actually a pretty huge story and just how lacking the scheme is and how the deep, deep lack of compassion and care at the center of it, which I think is pretty emblematic of the state's response all around. So like they're trying to put a price on people's trauma. There's different layers to the scheme, and you know, people who were born in mother and baby homes and were in there for less than 6 months are entitled to nothing. Which is really, like, as a lot of people said, like, listen, it wasn't about the amount of time that anybody spent in there. It was about family bonds being torn apart. It was about the trauma of your human rights been taken away. It was all of that sort of stuff. And so now what it looks like is that survivors and people who faced abuse in those institutions are going to have to make a choice around whether they take whatever scraps the government is now offering them, which in some cases is very little. They would then have to sign a legal waiver saying that they would never take any legal action against the state around what happened to them. And what also I think is fairly nuts is that the state are going to the church, the Catholic Church, and saying, would you volunteer to contribute to this 800 million redress scheme? Which is, to me, I mean, I remember I read one interview this morning with a survivor. She was saying the Criminal Assets Bureau should be taken in and their assets should be seized and sold and distributed in a much, much wider scheme made available. You know, and I think, like, it's fairly disgraceful, and I think it's just emblematic of a deep lack of care, and that the state and the government know that they need to do something, that they've been caught out, that there needs to be something that they can point to and say that we've done this, here's the redress scheme. But it's just putting survivors in a really horrendous position of deciding whether or not to take the 10, 15 grand they might get from the scheme and an enhanced medical card, whatever that means, or really, really bring the state to task and actually see people be held to account. But from what I can see, this is completely an avoidance of accountability. And I think we'll be buried in some ways. We'll be saying, oh, we've done the redress scheme and that's it. But it's pretty shocking.
It is. And I know the left and we've all been arguing for years. It's not like the Catholic Church can't afford to contribute. Having a voluntarist system in terms of redress around this stuff is just—it's absolutely bonkers. It's beyond disrespectful to the people that they abused in there. Like, these are the state is at fault. The Catholic Church is equally, if not more so, at fault for what it allowed to happen in these homes. And they made a profit out of it back then, and they're still not being asked to contribute. Like, it's mental. Like, one of the ways they made profits, obviously, was taking children and selling them to American couples and stuff. Like, just horrific stuff. And they're not being asked. They're being asked nicely to please give us a little bit of a dig out with this stuff, rather than just Criminal Assets Bureau or Religious Assets Bureau or whatever you want to call it. Go in there, take what you can out of them and give it to the victims, because they're the ones that deserve it. So I'm going to move on to the Kyle Rittenhouse story just briefly. I don't know if anybody else has been paying attention to it, but Kyle Rittenhouse, who turned up to a Black Lives Matter protest last year in Wisconsin, shot dead. I think it was two people, or was it three people? He shot a number of people anyway. He arrived with an illegal firearm, an AK-47, an assault weapon, and two people ended up dead. And he has been found not guilty. And you mentioned it earlier on, Emily. Donald Trump's tweet said, congratulations to Kyle Rittenhouse for being found innocent of all charges. It's called being found not guilty. And by the way, if that's not self-defense, nothing is. The guy came along. So basically what's happened in this case, I won't dwell on it too long, but Wisconsin, which is where it took place, the law allows a defendant to claim self-defense, even in a situation where their actions provoke a violent response. So he can in Wisconsin, you can provoke violence from somebody. They come at you, you're entitled to shoot them dead. What a nuts country. What an absolute crazy country. But to turn up to a Black Lives Matter protest after after someone had already been murdered by a police officer the previous day or a couple of days beforehand in Kenosha, and then to go and kill, and he gets found not guilty. And I can just only imagine what's about to happen again in the United States, because this is all going to blow up. It's a bonkers country. Like, how do they allow this? The judge allowed him, or instructed the jury to forget about the fact that it was an illegal weapon that he had, that he had no entitlement to have this weapon. Just forget about that bit. And then obviously all of the innocent or not guilty verdict flows from that. So I don't know if anybody else wants to jump in on that, or if you have any other stories, Michelle.
Yeah, no, it's extremely chilling, and it's really going to set a horrendous precedent for what else can come from there. It's actually quite scary. It's very, very, very scary. Like, yeah, the rise of the far right in America is terrifying, and it is a lesson for us here in Ireland as well, because we tend to follow a lot of American trends, unfortunately. So it's a message to the left here as well, to make sure we keep our eye on the game when it comes to activity here in Ireland as well.
And I think it's also like about the far right, but also about the how institutions have always been this way. There is no justice system in the United States, and I would say there isn't really a justice system here either, and that things are stacked to produce injustice, and that it actually is America is functioning exactly how it always did. And these far right guys kind of show up and are you know, decent poster boys from them, but it's the judges and it's the lawyers and it's the politicians and the police and it's all of the institutions that are there to uphold this. And I think that the same happens here. We saw what happened with George McKencho. So I think we have to be very vigilant.
Yeah, and I watched Joe Biden getting onto a helicopter, being interviewed about this and saying that, you know, about America, that the jury system works. So, you know, basically congratulating, you know, people talk, he's no Donald Trump, let's be honest about it. But at the same time, to be saying something like that about Kyle Rittenhouse on the back of this, you know, you just have to think of some of the other cases, like the thousands of other cases that have happened in the United States where the jury system was flawed and people were executed for the flawed jury system. So what a statement to come out with. The jury system works. So we have to support it.
Yeah, works for white men. Like, it's pure white supremacy, like.
Yeah, it's nuts.
Yeah, Biden's just the fluffier face, but you know.
Yeah. Here we are again, just to wrap up sort of the podcast, unless anyone else has anything to come in with, but I'll stick to Joe Biden. In the quotes of the week there, it says, something we're considering, is the quote, but it says Joe Biden has confirmed that the United States is considering a diplomatic boycott of the Beijing Winter Olympics over China's human rights record. What a week to say China's human rights record is bad, when you can actually turn up to a Black Lives Matter protest, provoke people, shoot them dead, and then go, but China, like, it's, what a country. Right, okay, I don't know, has anyone else got any stories? We wrap up. Okay, we'll wrap up. Listen, thanks to our undercover reporter there, Michelle Byrne, who attended the data center on behalf of Data Center Conference and on behalf of Bees and Pandas Everywhere. I want to thank our special guest, Emily Duffy, again for joining us from Parable, founder of Parable Communications, and giving us an update on what's going on the Oscar Traynor Road. We've been the week at work. We're part of the Left Block Project, alternative media and education project. If you want to support the podcast, or you want to support some of the work that we're doing, you can do so at patreon.com/leftblock. And talk to you all again next week. Thank you.